This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.
The debt ceiling standoff continues.
Kevin McCarthy is saying, I need some deep spending cuts. The White House is saying, we are offering you a freeze in spending. They have to find a meeting spot in the middle.
And a growing number of the migrants reaching the U.S.'s southern border are kids.
You hear aid workers in Panama who had been working with migrants now for a couple years. They say that they used to only see men, groups of men, come through the jungle. And now you see entire families, groups of teenagers.
Plus, why shares in American banks are trading like meme stocks. It's Wednesday, May 24th. I'm Dion Rabowan for The Wall Street Journal, filling in for Anne-Marie Fertoli. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that move the world today. If you miss the days of meme stock trading, when shares of companies like AMC or GameStop broke traditional volatility metrics, there's a new sector of the market to watch: regional banks. And while it may not seem like PacWest has a lot in common with BlackBerry or Bed Bath & Beyond, Wall Street Journal markets reporter Gunjan Banerjee says there are some similarities.
What we've seen is that the forces that helped drive stocks like GameStop and AMC to record after record in 2021 during the peak of the retail trading frenzy have really helped drive a lot of volatility in the regional bank stocks. We're seeing, you know, information move at a lightning fast pace on social media, both rumor and fact. We're seeing options trading exploding, and we're seeing a lot of individual investors also jumping into the market, either to bet against the stocks or to pile in and kind of position for a rebound.
But the potential consequences are a bit more serious this time around, because bank failures don't just affect the bank.
This is important because it's not like volatility in stocks like GameStop and AMC. Banks and how they do business have a really big implication on the U.S. economy. So what we saw this year is that volatility in shares of regional banks at times led these banks to pull back on lending activity because depositors were getting freaked out and pulling money from the banks. And as a result, they had to be more cautious in other parts of their business.
Turning to the debt ceiling, it didn't seem like it would be this hard. Those are the words of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. When McCarthy talked to reporters today, he sounded, let's say, exasperated.
We're not going to default. We're going to solve this problem. I will stay with it until we can get it done. But let's be honest about this. We have to spend less than we spent last year. It is not my fault that the Democrats cannot give up on their spending.
Well then, as a deal before the Treasury's June 1st deadline starts to look less likely, it's time to start talking about what happens if Democrats and Republicans can't come to an agreement on the debt ceiling. Siobhan Hughes, who covers Congress for the Journal, says the looming deadline hasn't been able to push lawmakers much closer together.
The key has to do with spending cuts. Kevin McCarthy is saying, I need some deep spending cuts, maybe not to 2022 levels, which is what my right wing wants, but cuts. The White House is saying, we are offering you a freeze in spending. That's significant because when you factor in inflation, it essentially amounts to a cut, and we can't give from there. They have to find a meeting spot in the middle.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said today, during a virtual appearance at the Wall Street Journal's CEO Council Summit in London, that her department is, quote, not involved in planning for what happens if there's a default. So does anyone have a clear understanding of what may not get paid or who may not get paid?
Well, there's going to be uncertainty around this. And so while we don't have definite information, we have some clues based on conversations I've had and also some transcripts of Fed minutes from the last debt ceiling crisis. There's a thought that prioritization would happen. So, for example, people owning treasuries would get those interest payments. There's a thought that Social Security, for example, too important to go unpaid, so those checks would come in. But the things I've heard on the target list are, for example, contractors. People doing business with the government might not get their checks on time. I have heard that payments that go out to states, maybe not for Medicaid, but other programs, those payments might not arrive on time. And so everybody's going to sweat it out and figure out whether or not they are on the target list.
That was Wall Street Journal Congress reporter Siobhan Hughes. And the banking crisis is over. The CEOs of UBS and Barclays said at the Wall Street Journal CEO Council Summit in London today that they believe this phase, when deposits flood out of a bank, its stock price tanks, and government regulators have to step in, has passed. What may not be over, the executive said, is a crisis for consumers and businesses. Barclays CEO C.S. Venkatakrishnan said many banks will be forced to change their business models in the coming years, and that could include cutting back on lending. Citigroup will spin off Mexican consumer bank Banamex, ending an attempt to sell the bank after a year-long process. Citi said today it will seek to take Banamex public, a process it expects to drag into 2025. Banamex has 1,300 branches and 13 million customers in Mexico, and the country's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, had publicly sought job protections as part of any sale. Selling Banamex would also have come with hefty capital charges for the bank that go away with an IPO. Citi has told investors the IPO of Banamex will allow Citi to begin buying back its own stock after having paused for a year. Coming up, why a rising number of unaccompanied children are trekking thousands of miles to seek asylum in the United States. That's after the break.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
An unprecedented number of unaccompanied minors, under the age of 18, often traveling alone or separated from their parents, are making the over 3,000-mile trek from South America in a dangerous bid to make it to the U.S., according to Panama migration officials and UN data. En route, migrants often cross the Darien Gap jungle between Colombia and Panama. As new migration policies under the Biden administration have left tens of thousands of migrants waiting in Mexico and Central American countries for U.S. asylum appointments, aid workers say there are few signs of a slowdown in the number of families and unaccompanied children continuing to march north from South America. Cajal Villas has been covering this issue for The Wall Street Journal, and he joins me now from Bogota, Colombia. You've written about the rising number of people under 18 years old making this trip. What stuck out to you most about what you found?
I guess the most concerning element is just the sheer volume and the perhaps the lack of installed capacity to handle so many people. So last year was a record year for U.S.-bound migration through Panama. We saw 248,000 people go through last year, most of them actually in the last few months of 2022. This year, we've just in the first 4 months, we've seen about 128,000 already cross. And there's expectations from the UN and Panamanian migration officials that that number could rise to 400,000 this year. Vast majority of them, I would say about three quarters or more, are coming from countries that have been particularly problematic in South America. Many Venezuelans, for example, left Venezuela several years ago and just never were able to get settled in anywhere. And so now they're trying to go towards the U.S. So there's economic issues and there's also crime issues. Ecuador has become a country that's seen its murder rate rise dramatically in the last year or two. And so it's pushed lots of people out of the country. And now because the Darien is seen as not so impenetrable as it used to be, many kids and youths decide to give it a go. It's a patch of wilderness, a very rugged patch of wilderness, a 70-mile stretch of almost virgin jungle that's between Colombia and Panama, with mountains and treacherous river crossings and you know, everything that goes along with it, you know, from wild and dangerous animals to mosquitoes that can get you sick along the way. And so you hear aid workers in Panama who have been working with migrants now for a couple years. They say that they used to only see men, groups of men come through the jungle. And now you see entire families, groups of teenagers. There's been kind of a multiplier effect there where more and more migrants are taking the route and then more inspiring more and more to take the journey themselves. As far as why there's a lot of children taking the route, there's also a couple different explanations. They often get separated from their parents along the route. We've also spoken to many migrants who have just been living on their own the last few years, teenagers, because they've just been unable to find a new life in other countries in South America.
You also spoke with some of the aid workers, some of the folks in these areas and migration authorities. Why do children pose a unique challenge for some of these authorities who often have limited resources?
So the big issue with children is that by international human rights laws, especially child protection laws, which virtually all countries in the Americas are signatories, they're actually legally obligated to hold and care for children until they're reunited with parents. So it's become kind of a heavy burden, I would say, for many Central American countries who have actually don't have a long experience dealing with mass migration, especially Panama. I mean, the popularity of the Darien route, it's a route that's been used for many years, but really only in the last few years have we seen these six-digit figures, numbers of people kind of moving through. And so there's very evident insufficient capacity to hold kids, and not just children, also, you know, pregnant mothers, lactating mothers. There's very few facilities for these kinds of people who are making this arduous journey. And so it becomes a much more problematic matter for migration officials throughout Central America.
And what about in the U.S.? What are some of the unique challenges that U.S. migration officials are dealing with?
So far, we have heard from the Department of Health and Human Services. They had announced that they were going to be increasing some of their lodging capacities along the southern border right around the expiration of Title 42 on May 11th. There was a lot of expectations for a big rise in the number of young people showing up at the border, namely because young folks, especially unaccompanied minors, have been exempt from some of the restrictions on migrants in the past. They don't really have to wait for appointments. They don't get deported generally. And so there is some semblance of an incentive almost to show up as a unaccompanied minor because you might get preferential treatment.
Cajal Villas, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In other news, retailer Target says it will be removing some products related to Pride Month from stores because of concerns about their employees' safety. A Target spokeswoman said people have confronted workers in stores, knocked down Pride merchandise displays, and put threatening posts on social media with video from inside stores. Target will continue to sell Pride-related items in stores, but will remove items that have been at the center of the most controversial behavior in recent days, she said. The spokeswoman added, quote, "We have a long-standing commitment to the LGBTQ community, and we stand firm in that. But the reality is that the safety situation has become untenable." The great Tina Turner has died. Her powerhouse singing and dancing took her to the peak of pop stardom. An 8-time Grammy winner, Turner channeled raw emotion in songs like River Deep, Mountain High, and What's Love Got to Do with It? Turner suffered from renal disease, which resulted in the 2017 transplant of a kidney donated by her husband. A spokesman for Turner confirmed her death. She was 83. And we reported earlier this week that process servers were having a hard time serving former basketball player Shaquille O'Neal. He is a named claimant in a case brought by investors in the cryptocurrency exchange FTX against its owners and the celebrities that appeared in its ads. O'Neal was finally served last night in Miami while he was commentating for the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals at the venue formerly known as FTX Arena. Lawyers for O'Neal didn't immediately comment. And finally, Taylor Swift fans crashed Ticketmaster. Now they're rattling StubHub. The astronomical demand for tickets to Taylor Swift's Eras Tour is leading to a big increase in resales on sites like StubHub. The company says that 70% of orders for Taylor Swift tickets on StubHub are fans reselling tickets rather than professional ticket brokers. That's double the usual amount. 63% of the issues from these ticket resales are coming from amateur ticket resellers on StubHub. Our music industry reporter Ann Steele says the fans aren't as familiar with the process of securing and delivering tickets to customers, and that's causing issues.
not all of these fan sellers are as familiar with StubHub. So, you know, what they're seeing are either these fans not deliver tickets or deliver tickets, but not let StubHub know that they've delivered the tickets. So StubHub has to assume those orders are canceled, and then they're prompting the buyers to go in and look for new tickets. But in many cases, these buyers bought months ago, and a nosebleed seat that they paid for $500 in November is now $2,000. So when they're prompted to go look for new tickets, there's just nothing at the price that they paid before. So it's been really hard to make good on those orders.
StubHub's penalties for sellers not delivering tickets depend on the size of their mistake and end result for the buyer. In some cases, the company can charge the seller what it costs to replace the ticket, which in many cases is more than 5 times the amount originally listed. And that's what's news for this Wednesday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. I'm Dion Rabowan for The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.